Oh, another week, another $1 trillion of shareholder value turned to pixie dust. When will it end? And when do we start talking in trillions like this? How many people have any idea how big a trillion is? A trillion grains of table salt would fill my living room up to the ceiling. A trillion drops of water would need a largish reservoir to hold them. A trillion human hairs laid side by side with no space between them would go all the way round the Earth's equator. Travelling back in time, a trillion seconds would land you among the flint nappers of the Old Stone Age. If the territory of the United States were divided into a trillion equal square parts, each part would be about 10 feet on a side. If you were to jump as high as Olympic high jumpers jump, you would have jumped a trillionth of the distance to the planet Uranus, and so on. There's a lot of us, and we're the richest nation that ever was in the history of the world, but a trillion is still a mighty big number. Well, I'm sure our new president-elect will know what to do when he has the reins of office firmly in his hands. But first, he has to deal with his auntie. I just love this story about Barack Obama's aunt. In case you didn't catch it, here's the executive summary. Obama tells us in his autobiography that when he went to Kenya in 1988 to look for his roots, the first person to greet him was this aunt, his father's half-sister, name of Zaituni Onyango. According to the account he gave in his book, Aunt Zaituni's first words to him were, "Welcome home." Then, he tells us, she kissed him on both cheeks. Well, in the year 2000, Aunt Zaituni came to the USA on a temporary visa. Whether her nephew greeted her with cheek kisses is not known. Well, not to me at any rate. What is known is that when her visa expired, Aunt Zaituni applied for asylum on the grounds that she didn't want to go back to Kenya. Her application was rejected in 2004, and a judge ordered her to leave the country. Aunt Zaituni chose not to obey the court, thereby voluntarily changing her status to fugitive alien. As such, she went on living in the public housing that Boston Housing Authority had provided for her the year before. As an illegal alien, of course, Aunt Zaituni's first impulse was to find one of those jobs that Americans won't do, and she quickly found one, as a health advisor to the people in her public housing complex, with a salary paid by Boston Housing Authority. Or, to put it another way, since municipal housing authorities receive state and federal subsidies, Aunt Zaituni was paid by the taxpayers of Boston and Massachusetts, and the USA. All this was discovered by investigative journalists at the London Times, American journalists being, of course, much too high-minded to concern themselves with such grubby matters, and anyway being too busy totting up the cost of Sarah Palin's wardrobe. Well, I don't know how much Aunt Zaituni's salary is, but she scraped up enough cash to contribute $260 to her nephew's presidential campaign. Illegally, since she's not a citizen. Our president-elect returned those donations, though not until after they'd been publicised, and he says that he thinks his aunt should obey the law. Oh, good call, Barack. For those listeners not familiar with the law in this area, permit me to explain. The law is that the fugitive alien keeps on appealing her case forever, while continuing to live in taxpayer-subsidized housing, drawing a taxpayer-funded salary from Boston Housing Authority, and being treated at taxpayer expense in her local hospital emergency room if she's sick. And if you object to any of that, the law says you can go boil your head. Everything clear? And then there's this touchy business of the Obama kids' schooling in Washington, D.C. Should they attend D.C. public schools, as Amy Carter did? Or should they be enrolled in a Tony private school, like Chelsea Clinton? It's not an easy call for the Obamas. Amy Carter's experience wasn't a very happy one. She wasn't allowed into the school playground at recess because it was too near the street. On the other hand, a left-wing liberal sending his kids to snooty private schools is going to come in for some mockery, as Clinton did. In the case of the Obamas, there's also the R factor to consider, D.C. public schools being 83% black and 10% Hispanic. If the Obamas send Sasha and Malia to a posh private school, they'll be muttering that they are shunning their own people. My guess is that they'll go with public schooling. And actually, why wouldn't they? Back in April, Andrew Colson at the Cato Institute computed that the District of Columbia spends nearly $25,000 per pupil if you factor in all spending and all administration. That's $10,000 more than the average for DC private schools. Hey, this is the best public school system in the nation, or at least the most expensive. Alternatively, the Obamas could revert to the old aristocratic model and just bring in tutors for the kids to teach them at home. There must be plenty of people available to do some home schooling for these girls. How about Aunt Zaituni? Bailout mania. Come and get your bailout. Now, as everybody knows, the basement of the White House contains hundreds of brass-bound oak chests, each one filled with gold sovereigns. This is called government money. When things are going along smoothly, the government just keeps quiet and hopes that everyone will forget about it. But when too many banks have run themselves into the ground with improvident lending, or some huge industrial conglomerate, you know, an automaker, for example, has allowed predatory unions to jack up its costs so high that its prices aren't competitive anymore, well, then the clasps come off those chests and government money is showered on these unfortunate enterprises so that they can go on doing what they were doing so well. This is just fine because the money being used there is not your money or my money, or, heaven forbid, money that foreigners have given us in return for promises to pay it back with interest. No, it's government money, you see, so everything's fine. As soon as the crisis is over, the Treasury people will fasten down the clasps on those big old money chests, turn out the basement lights, close and lock the basement doors. And you know what happens then? It's really amazing. All those gold coins left alone there in the dark in those chests, they breed like mushrooms. So the next time there's a crisis, there will be just as many as there were before, you see? Government money, it's wonderful stuff. It's not like your money or mine. You know, when you spend it, it's gone. Government money is always there, as much as you want. So, come and get your bailout. The line forms on the left here. Next. 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 Most of us got our image of the Imperial Japanese Air Force from watching movies about Pearl Harbor or from reading about kamikaze pilots. You know how it goes. Fearless young men with chrysanthemums that their sweethearts gave them tucked into their flak jackets, hurtling themselves at the enemy, screaming Banzai, or Torah, 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 or some such. Well, that was then. This is now. What the Japanese Air Force is mainly into these days is not so much suicidal heroism as suicidal embarrassment. Item. General Toshio Tomogami was actually the head of Japan's Air Force until recently. Until October the 31st, to be exact, when he was fired by Japan's Prime Minister. The occasion of his being fired was that he had entered an essay contest sponsored by a construction billionaire. The set topic for the essay was The True Outlook for Modern and Contemporary History. The general's outlook was that Japan fought World War II in self-defense after liberating Asia from Western imperialism, and that Pearl Harbor was a dastardly trap laid by the United States, and that it is high time for Japan to, quote, reclaim her glorious history. These arguments proved so satisfactory to the contest judges, they gave the general first prize. Japan's Asian neighbours were not so pleased, and Prime Minister Taro Aso did what he had to do, probably with mixed feelings, as some controversial past statements of his suggest that Prime Minister Aso more or less shares the general's views. Item. A male Japanese Air Force major from the Matsushima Air Base in Miyagi, northern Japan, we don't know his name, was caught naked while shopping for women's underwear. He has been suspended from his duties for 10 days, said a spokeswoman at the base. The major had been on his way home from a late-night farewell party for a colleague when he decided, on an impulse, to take off his clothes behind a convenience store before going in and buying some panties and pantyhose. The spokeswoman tells us that, quote, he had just his wallet and his shoes on him. Interesting. We are not told where on his person the major's wallet was actually located, but then perhaps we don't want to be. Memo to the Japanese Air Force High Command. If you're going to reclaim your nation's glorious history, you might want to tell that major to reclaim his dress uniform from behind that convenience store first. There is no instance known to history of a greater co-prosperity sphere being established by men wearing pantyhose. Time for one of our occasional encounters with the religion of peace. Actually, the way things are shaking down here, Islam is not so much the religion of peace as the religion of taking hair-trigger offence at every conceivable opportunity. Here's the latest case. Now, follow me closely here. The 2010 Soccer World Cup is going to be held in South Africa. The merchandising of souvenirs has already begun. One of the souvenirs is a soccer ball with the flags of many countries on it. One of the countries whose flags are represented on this soccer ball is Saudi Arabia. Now, the Saudi flag includes a verse from the Quran on it. You know, just the way our flag includes a phrase from the Constitution. It's perfectly normal. So that means you've got the word of Allah there on a soccer ball, which someone might kick. Quote from South Africa's Council of Muslim Theologians. And I bet you didn't know South Africa had one, did you? Listener, every place has one. Your town has one. Your block has one. Quote, the use of text which Muslims consider sacred has the potential of offending adherents of the Islamic faith, end quote. This little piece of grievance-mongering, in case you haven't been paying attention, is the latest in a long series. For years, agitators in Muslim countries have been claiming that the Coca-Cola trademark is actually an insult to Muhammad if you read it in a mirror. In 2005, Burger King restaurants in Britain withdrew one of their ice cream products because Muslim customers said that the label design, which was a sort of swirl of ice cream, looked like the Arabic script for Allah if it was turned sideways. In 2003, a different ice cream company, also in Britain, was forced to scrap its logo of intertwined red and yellow hearts after Muslims said it looked like the word Allah in Arabic if viewed upside down and backwards. 6 years before that, Nike pulled 38,000 pairs of basketball shoes after the Council on American-Islamic Relations said that the logo, which this time was just the word air in a sort of swirly script lettering, looked like Allah in Arabic again when viewed from a certain angle. And way back before that, in the early 90s, a Chinese company exporting shoes to the Middle East got into trouble because the rubber pattern on the soles of the shoes looked like, can you guess, Allah again. In the taking offence game, I think the Muslims have even opened up a lead on African Americans, which I would not have thought possible. Mind you, we all have our own sensitivities. This bottle of Glenmorangie single malt here on my desk has a wee design on the label that I could swear, if I squint at it by the light of a full moon while hanging by my heels from the doorway, looks the spitting image of old Charles Darwin. Hey, I'm offended. You know what, though? I'm going to drink the blessed stuff anyway. Mind you, Christians aren't blameless either. The central event in the religion of my ancestors was the resurrection of Jesus Christ. At the place where this occurred, there now stands a Christian church, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. The duties of looking after this holiest of all churches are divided between 6 different Christian sects, under an arrangement going back to 1767 in the days of the Ottoman Empire. Each of the sects has certain territorial rights in the church. Each has certain allotted times at which it can perform its rites. No changes can be made, no maintenance work can be done, unless all 6 of the sects agree, which, of course, they never do. The keys to the main entrance of the church have been held by a Muslim family since the 12th century, because the Christians don't trust one another. If you look at the front of the church, you see 2 big windows above the entrance set in large alcoves. There's a short ladder in the right-hand alcove placed there in the 1840s. It hasn't been moved since because the 6 custodian sects can't agree among themselves on who should remove it. The Egyptian Coptic Church keeps a monk stationed on the church roof at all times to maintain their claim to that part of the structure. Well, one hot summer day in 2002, the monk moved his chair from its agreed spot into the shade. The Ethiopian Copts took this as an insult. A fight broke out, and 11 monks ended up in hospital. In another incident, at Easter 2004, Eastern Orthodox monks conducting a ceremony, noticed that Roman Catholics had left a door open. Another insult, another fistfight. Well, last Sunday, during celebrations for the Feast of the Holy Cross, there was yet another rumble. This time Eastern Orthodox versus Armenians. Things got so bad, the Israeli police were called in, but the fighting monks turned and attacked them too. TV news footage shows one monk with a very nasty gash on his forehead. I guess he was a little slow turning the other cheek. All right, but what I want to know is this. Doesn't it occur to any of these idiot monks in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, for crying out loud, that this kind of thing is a really, really bad advertisement for Christianity? At the Last Supper, Jesus told his disciples, "This is my commandment, that ye love one another as I have loved you." Well, perhaps after another 2,000 years, it might start to sink in.
The English are best. I wouldn't give tuppence for all of the rest.
Yes, we are. As an English person in America, one thing I get asked a lot is, what's the difference between England and Britain and the UK? How does that work? All right. Listen carefully and I'll explain. There are two big islands over there, and lots of little ones. The Romans called the bigger island Britannia, and the smaller one Hibernia. So Britain is that big island, and Ireland is the other one. Well, that's geography. Politically, Britain has three parts, England, Wales, and Scotland. Scot is the medieval name for an Irishman, so Irishmen moved from Ireland to what was then Pictland and merged with the Picts to make it Scotland. Meanwhile, the English, who were from Denmark, moved into southern Britain from the east, driving the original British into the mountains of the west, where they became Welsh, that being the Old English word for a foreigner. Much later, some of the Scots, who were Protestant by that point, moved back to Ireland, which had stayed Catholic, and settled there, forming the Scots-Irish. Everything clear? Good. All that is preface to a news story from this week. A local authority in Wales has put out a booklet advising its employees not to use the word British because, quote, "The idea of British implies a false sense of unity. Many Scots, Welsh and Irish resist being called British, and the land denoted by the term contains a wide variety of cultures, languages and religions," end quote. Reporters tracked down the author of this booklet. It turned out to be a defrocked member of the British government, a chap called Ron Davis. Mr. Davis lost his government position 10 years ago after what he himself described as a moment of madness with a male stranger in a South London park. He went off to a much lesser job in the Welsh Assembly, but then he lost that one too, after allegations that he'd had another moment of madness with another male person in a wood. Mr. Davis has denied these later allegations, claiming that he was only in the wood looking for badgers. Well, now he's being badgered by reporters over this booklet telling people to stop saying British. It's all very peculiar, but then what can you expect from a Welshman?
The Welshman's dishonest, he cheats when he can, and little and dark, more like monkey than man. He works underground with a lamp in his hat, and he sings far too loud, far too often, and flat.
Just a few odds and ends here. From the Associated Press, a story that paranoia is on the rise. Quote, "Paranoia, once assumed to afflict only schizophrenics, may be a lot more common than previously thought, According to British psychologist Daniel Freeman, nearly one in four Londoners regularly have paranoid thoughts. End quote. There you go, paranoia on the rise. Yeah, right. That's what they want you to think. Latinos push for cabinet posts, it says here. Cecilia Munoz, vice president of the National Council of the Race, is demanding two cabinet positions for members of the race. The United States is about to get its first quota cabinet, I fear. A chap named Spike Lee, who people tell me is something in the movie business, wants us to start dating events as before Obama and after Obama. I assume this new calendar will begin with Wonder Boy's inauguration, so that we are right now just coming to the end of year one, B.O. Speaking of B.O., scientists in Philadelphia claim that they can identify a human being uniquely by his odour print. His odour print, even if he's been eating curry or chilies. Huh. I need to introduce these guys to my wife's pickled garlic. Yes, that's garlic pickled. Beats me how we ever managed to have two kids. A journalist in Britain has trashed the late Queen Mother, who died in 2002 at the age of 101. Or was it in 2001 at the age of 102? I forget. This journalist claims that the Queen Mum was a bigot. Ooh! When he told her that he'd just come from a European summit, the good lady said, quote, "It will never work, you know. It will never work with all those Huns, Wops and Dagos." God bless the royal family. What else? Oh, here's Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Quote, "The GOP's long transformation into the party of the unreasonable right, a haven for racists and reactionaries, seems likely to accelerate as a result of the impending defeat." End quote. Well, from your mouth to God's ear, Paul. Finally, thieves in a village 200 miles northeast of Moscow have stolen a church. The church had been out of use for a while, but Orthodox officials were thinking of starting up services again. When they went to scope out the place, though, they found it gone. Thieves had stolen it brick by brick. Well, probably vengeful Armenians from the Holy Sepulchre. Well, there we are, ladies and gents. Another week, another bailout. When will it end? As a politician once observed, a trillion here, a trillion there. Pretty soon you're burying Krugerrands in the backyard. Not to worry, though. I'm sure our new president will soon have things humming again. With his great reserves of worldly experience and the seasoned wisdom of Joe Biden, we'll soon be back on track. So let's look for that silver lining. Face the future with a smile. Keep our peckers up and sing a cheery song as we go about our day's work. All together now.